This is After Dark number 5, this is tape number 12, and this is side 1. And let's pick it up where we left off on tape number 11 with Bruce Conti.
As I understand from Mark, on some of the modes, you have to switch through certain modes to get to a mode or something.
Yeah. So it just takes a while to get used to. It's not as easy to use as some of the portables. The 2010 is a fairly easy receiver to use. You get everything right there up front, and it's all either push button. There's dedicated buttons for each function, as opposed to the R8, where you have one button that does several functions.
Well, I guess the question now to ask is one on design. Now, you work in the electronics business and are used to some of the higher technology things which are coming down the pike. If you were to sit down with the CEO of Sony and tell him exactly what kind of options you need in a receiver to make it a killer machine, I mean, what kind of things would you ask for to make the best receiver on the market?
Wow, that's a good question. Well, first of all, definitely, as we've been talking about, the higher quality IF filters are a plus. Definitely need those in there. Passband tuning, notch filters, perhaps some DSP, digital signal processing of the audio, so you can really take out noise and tune in the audio to what you really want to hear. Let's see, perhaps some type of regenerative tuning on your input would be nice, although that'd probably be asking for a little too much. Definitely portability helps. 12-volt DC input, so you can sit in your car at the beach and listen without killing your budget on D batteries. Or let's see, what else could we use in there? Maybe to come with it, a nice tunable loop or front end, a separate tunable front end or LC tank circuit on your antenna input, something of that sort, so you can pre-tune the stuff coming in so the radio doesn't have to work as hard. I could think of a lot of things to add to the receiver.
You know, and you think about the radio like the 2010, and I guess one of the things, from my standpoint, I do DXing, but I also do a lot of air check collecting and such. So, I'm interested in a machine which will do the DX, but I also like something which sounds good to be able to record on. And I guess the thing that's kind of funny to me is you got the 2010 out there. It's in production. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands they probably sold. Well, why couldn't they make that in a car radio or a convenient table radio or something? It's always, there's always a big step between the two.
Yeah, and I guess nowadays that's a real problem with car radios, because all the emphasis is on FM, so they don't put much into the AM section anymore. So I'm even, my car radio is a stock Ford. I don't know who makes their receivers, but it's terrible. I'll be driving through the city, and for instance, on 1360, I'll be getting the harmonic from 680 and WRKO. So they're terrible.
And the funny thing about it is, it seems like the newer cars even have worse radios. Because I had a 1981 Ford Fairmont, and the in-dash radio in that was, I would say, and this is my own opinion here, but I mean, it was better than a Super Radio 3 right now is. And comparing my wife's Oldsmobile's radio to that, I have the same problem you have. I got images all over the place and noise.
Yeah, and it's terrible. I guess the National Association of Broadcasters have been trying to do something about it, but they haven't been successful. And working with the FCC, they pretty much got the FCC to finally agree to standardize the AM stereo to the Motorola Sequam, and they came up with this thing called AMAX, which was a special label you could put on a receiver to say it meets certain standards. And the problem is, no one's doing it.
Yeah, I haven't seen a radio that has AMAX on it, really. Other than I think it's a Denon. Has it?
Yeah, if you have $600 to spend.
Yeah. But, it's funny when you bring in somebody who is a, let's say, a better-than-average listener of radio, and in our studio here, we've got a McKay Dimick receiver, and you you play audio, which is connected to a decent amplifier and speaker off that radio, or even a 2010 in the wideband position, the AM actually sounds pretty decent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree. I've actually heard a couple of demonstrations of AM stereo receivers, and you tune them into your AM stereo stations, and they sound almost as good as FM. I say that kind of under my breath, because really, if you listen closely, the FM does sound better. You can get a wider bandwidth off the FM than AM, but still, I mean, it's certainly good enough quality so that the average listener isn't going to notice the difference.
And I think that the word there is average listener. I mean, some of us, when we listen to the AM stereo, we're listening and we're trying to listen for noise. We're trying to listen for component errors within the decoding scheme. And the average person probably wouldn't even hear that, would they?
No. And in fact, a lot of your FM stations are multiplexing their signals. They've got subcarriers or some other things going on, so they aren't using their full bandwidth. And then some compress their audio, or they're doing other tricks. And actually, the music in some stations sounds pretty bad, but people just don't really notice it.
Yeah, because they're listening to, is it a background?
Yeah.
Instead of foreground.
Yeah.
Besides the TA and Latin America listening that you do, do you do any domestic DXing as well?
Oh, yeah. Just last weekend, I picked up the WPWA DX test on 1590. They were out of Pennsylvania. Sent them a report. That's pretty much what I limit my domestic listening to, is I go for the DX tests, and every once in a while, I'll do some sunset or sunrise skip listening. But then once the time comes where the TAs start coming in, or the stations from Latin America start to boom in, then that's where my interest kind of heads toward.
Yeah, what are some of the rarest stations that you've been able to hear?
Well, let's see. That's kind of a hard question, because as far as the Europeans go, for example, or anything from the transatlantic spectrum, I'm pretty much receiving all the same stuff that Mark or anyone else is reporting in the international DX Digest column of DX News. So probably the more exotic stuff I'm hearing is from Latin America to the south. The rarest, of course, would be the HCJB DX test from Ecuador. I heard the one they ran back on Memorial Day weekend of 1994. So that would be my most rare. Followed by Nicaragua on 620, which I guess is fairly easy to hear in the Midwest or out in the Plain States, but doesn't make it out to New England very often, so I was pretty happy to hear that. I sent them a reception report, and I haven't heard anything back yet, but at least I've got them on tape for a very...
And we can always hope that you get something back.
Yeah.
And do some of these stations usually QSL if you send them a report?
Sure they do. In fact, a lot of times they can be better verifiers than the domestic stations in the United States or Canada, mainly because especially the European stations are running high power with the intent to be heard in other countries besides their own. So they're usually very interested in hearing from DX listeners just because they want to know that they're still getting out. And of course, the fact that you're hearing them in the United States, that just makes them even more excited. And the only thing I have found is while the percentage of returns from international stations is usually better, the problem is you have to write your report in French or Spanish or whatever the native language is, and that can be difficult, takes a lot of time and effort. So I don't send too many reports out because I prefer to send them out in the native language as opposed to just sending an English report. Actually, I do that for two reasons. One, because I think I get a better response, and two, it's kind of out of respect for the their own language and culture. And, you know, it'd be the same thing as if they were sending a report or sending a letter to you in their language, and then you got to sit and try and figure out what they're saying. So I think it helps if you can send your reports in the native language, and that's not always possible, but the one benefit we have here in the United States is that English is pretty much spoken around the world. So no matter what station you write to, there's probably going to be someone on the staff that at least knows a little English and will be able to read your letter and respond.
Now, how much of a problem is it in trying to figure out what stations are which with the different languages that you have?
Actually, that makes it easier to identify the stations because there aren't too many stations on the various frequencies. Like, let's look through the WRTH and pick a frequency such as 711 kilohertz. You have a station from Denmark, one from Spain, one from Egypt, Estonia, France, and they all speak different languages. So if you can identify the language, then you've pretty much identified the station.
Now, these stations that you're talking about, are each one of those, for lack of a better description, are they basically like stations here in the United States? They're broadcasting to their own immediate area, and thus the programming is going to be, say, more like a AM radio station in the United States versus a shortwave station?
Definitely. That's part of the reason why I got into listening to broadcast band International DX. It's you get more of the local flavor of whatever country you're listening to, as opposed to shortwave, which is mainly geared toward politics, religion, or other types of propaganda. You know, so it's definitely more interesting. Although one thing I have noticed is how much Europe has become Americanized, because even though a lot of these stations are playing their own the music of their own cultures, it's often mixed with U.S. pop music. And I think that's becoming more and more prevalent, even on like the Spanish stations or stations from Morocco. You'll be hearing U.S. pop music mixed in with their own.
So basically the format of a radio station over there is going to be similar to what we have here, with the exception of just a different flavor.
Yeah, and you'll hear the different formats too. There'll be stations that are pretty much easy listening, and then others that are religious stations, and then some are more into the rock. Although a lot of the European stations are doing just like the our American counterparts and moving the music to FM, and it's getting more and more toward talk on AM.
Now, some of these stations that you're listening to, you know, one of the things that I guess kind of teased me off about a lot of our broadcasters here in the United States is the kind of complacent attitude they take toward giving an ID. And it's not uncommon to listen to a radio station here in the United States and not even hear an ID at the top of the hour, or maybe you'll hear the FM ID and just kind of a casual mention of the AM. How about some of these stations over in Europe?
It's no worse. It's no better in Europe.
Oh, really?
Especially with these stations from Spain. They're all on, for the most part, they're all on networks, nationwide networks. And these stations, I'll sit for hours listening to these stations, trying to pull out a local ID, and it's nearly impossible.
So it's like listening to the CBC on AM, right?
Yeah. Or it's no different than listening to, I'm trying to think of a network here that would, like Talk America Network, where you might get a station that just lets the network roll and they only ID at the top of the hour if you're lucky.
So if you happen to have a fade at about 10 seconds before the top of the hour, you're really screwed, aren't you?
Yep.
Oh, geez. Well, I was hoping it would be a little bit better, you know. Maybe they would actually give a couple interval signals and something to really give you a good ID on.
No, yeah, that's shortwave. AM out there is, or broadcast band is no different than here. They don't ID very often.
AM is AM no matter where you go.
Yeah, basically.
The TAs that you listen to, we talked a little bit about the fact that if you're near the salt water and near the ocean, you get a little bit better reception. How much does it tend to roll off as you get into the Midwest? I mean, can you hear TAs in the Midwest, or do you have to be on the Cape to be able to hear something?
Well, I can't speak from experience, but I know Mark Connolly has been able to hear Saudi Arabia and Morocco from Texas. And actually, what I'm really waiting for is Neil Kazaros, who just recently moved out to Illinois. I'm waiting for him to get set up and start reporting a few things. But I think some of the more powerful stations should be able to be heard in the Midwest, such as Saudi Arabia on 1521, perhaps Algeria on 891, Morocco on 1044. I just paged through the World Radio and TV Handbook and pick out the guys that are running 2,000 kilowatts or so, and I think you'd have a good chance of hearing a few of those in the Midwest.
So basically, you'd be able to hear the big guns, but some of the smaller stations you might not have a problem, or you might have a problem with.
Yeah, I have a feeling once you get too far inland, you won't have a problem with the pests from Spain like I do.
Now, if you let's suppose tomorrow you win the lottery. Which we all hope we could, but you could take a real long DX position and go someplace to sit down for a good week or so and do some DXing. Is there any particular place that you personally would like to go where you think it'd be a real good DX location?
Newfie is probably the most interesting place. I went out there for the 1993 DX expedition, and just driving in the car with the car radio on, we're picking up Luxembourg solid gold 1440, picking up Vatican radio on 1530.
Just a car radio?
Just on the car radio, driving down to the site.
Jeez.
That's a perfect location. Of course, that's the same location where Marconi was able to succeed with his first transatlantic communication. So it's the perfect location.
Now, when you go on some of these DX positions, what kind of things should you take along if you were to you have to start a list or so that you need to take this? Obviously, you have to take some batteries because you're going to need to power your radio. But what are some of the things that you need to provide?
Well, I try and travel light, especially in going into Canada, because I figure if I have too many things, the customs people will get a little nervous. So I try and keep it fairly light. I've actually got a nice compact de-expedition kit that I put together, and basically consists of my 2010 receiver. I have a MWDX5 phasing unit, one of Mark Connolly's designs. And then I take my World Radio and TV handbook. That's definitely needed material. Also, a good thing to carry around nowadays is the De-Expedition Handbook, which is the new book by Sean Axelrod that's all about his experience with De-Expeditions, along with complete logs from the 1991 and 93 Newfoundland De-Expeditions. So that's a really handy guide just to carry along to see what people are receiving. And then a few small tools, wire strippers, pliers, screwdrivers, of course, a complement of batteries, a tape recorder. I've got a small portable Radio Shack tape recorder I picked up for $35, and that thing works great. I keep a tape recorder running all the time, a good 20 hours or so worth of tapes, so you have something in case you need to review a few things later on when you're done. Of course, food. You know, something to snack on, because you get so excited with these de-expeditions. If that stuff starts rolling in, you don't have time to eat. So it's good to have, you know, some hard candy or maybe some candy bars or pretzels or something to snack on. Coffee is also good, instant coffee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you actually have something where you can heat up some coffee, then, or tea or something hot, to keep you going through the wee hours of the morning.
Now, tell me about this de-exposition itself. I mean, what about the site? Did you have to camp out, or was there local housing nearby?
We actually stayed at a hospitality house, as they called it. Or I guess it was
like a bed and breakfast type thing?
Yeah, it was like a bed and breakfast. It's basically used during the hunting seasons, you know, and the rest of the time. They don't get too much business. So, of course, that's when us DXers take over. And the site that we've been using is right on the water. So, and the neighbors don't seem to mind us running wires all over the place. So we're running 1,500-foot, 3,000-foot wires out in all directions. And the only problem with de-exing from the house was noise. And lucky for us, Mark brought along his noise reduction transformer matching kits, so we could set up remote grounds and then bring the match signals in down the transmission lines to the receivers, so we weren't picking up the house noise. But the site is a wonderful site. It's quiet. It's fairly quiet. It's remote. And as I say, the neighbors didn't seem to mind us running wires all over the place. Although some people looked at us with, I'm not sure whether they were curious or just thinking we're crazy running these wires everywhere. But, I'm sure the owners of the house are kind of bewildered too, with these guys listening to radios all hours of the night. And I know a lot of people, when I show them my hobby and I'll tune in a station such as Spain and you get all the noise and everything, they're kind of wondering, why am I doing this?
Why are you listening to noise, and why are you listening to something which you can't really hear?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I get that same look too. the site that you're on, are you running... are you running the wires on a vector toward the water, or is it parallel to the water?
Well, it's kind of both. Of course, you can't run right into, because it's right, the house is pretty much right on the water, so you can't run your wires right into the water. So pretty much running parallel to the shoreline in one direction, and then there's kind of like a peninsula that shoots out another direction, and we're running wires out that way. And then... also running wires away from the shore. So basically the wires away from the shore were used for nulling. By phasing them, we could pretty much phase out any interference from the west, so that further improved our reception to the east.
So the site that you were at is on the east coast, so to speak.
Yeah.
And what kind of interference, if any, did you get? I mean, what kind of things were you trying to null out?
Well, once again, it's kind of getting redundant here, but stations from Spain were the worst problem. We're actually trying to null out the stations from Spain so we could hear other stuff.
Stuff from Europe or?
Yeah, from Europe or Africa.
Okay.
And I guess the only other real problem, a couple of stations from Boston had fairly good signals. In fact, one of the stronger signals up there was from WUNR 1600. Which is very difficult to hear in New Hampshire. So,
so you got them in Newfoundland?
Yeah. but then you have the Canadian locals on 590, 740, the VOCM stations and CBC stations, which were problems at times. But for the most part, you didn't have too much difficulty with the domestics.
Now, with some of these Canadian stations going off the air and going over to FM, is that helping you out?
So far, not really, because the Canadian stations, at least here in New Hampshire, aren't much of a problem anyway. Most of the stuff I'm trying to hear is either to the south or to the east, so I'm pretty much nulling them out. They aren't really in the path. That's something I wanted to mention as another problem with DXing in the Midwest, and that's that you have domestics coming at you from every direction.
You're right.
And the advantage you have to being on a coastline is now you've limited the... directions that domestics are coming from. So that's a big help in trying to pick out some of the transatlantic or transpacific stations.
Let me jump over to antennas for a second and just kind of ask a preference question here. There's really two different kinds of small portable antennas, a little box loop and some of the amplified loops. If somebody wanted to do some DXing, say in North Carolina on one of the beaches or something like that, and had a 2010 or Super Radio 3, which antenna would probably work the best for them? Is there any real preference?
Well, if you have a AirCore box type loop, let's say that's a good 4x4 feet, you'll probably get pretty good gain off of that, and the advantage is you'll have low noise, as opposed to the smaller ferrite core, the loop, amplified loop, where one of the problems with that type of loop is it tends to be noisier, and plus the amplification adds to the noise. So with the really weak signals, you may do better with a large box loop, although they're kind of bulky and hard to handle. And for that reason, I myself use the ferrite core loops. I have one of the classic SM2 space magnets, which I carry around with me, also is for portable DXing. And that seems to work fairly well. Mark Connolly has had some designs show up in DX News using a special buffer amplifier, which is a much lower noise version of the stuff you can get commercially. And certainly if you want to do some amplification, you may want to consider one of his designs.
So if you're planning to get somewhere near the ocean or something, taking along one of those box loops would help you. Is there any particular rules of the trade, so to speak, that you have to abide by as far as where to camp out to be able to hear some decent DX?
Probably you want to get away from the cities or the metro areas, because the closer you are to a big city such as Boston or New York, then the more difficult it's going to be to take out some of the domestic interference. So, for instance, let's say if you're in the New York City area, you may want to head out Long Island toward the end of Long Island for your best DX. And here in the Boston area, if we go up to the North Shore, up toward Maine, or down on the Cape, then definitely that improves your chances of hearing the stuff. But if you get too close to the city, it becomes more difficult. Although right in Boston, you still can get some fairly decent DX if you get down on the harbor or shoreline. The other thing to remember is that you want to be inconspicuous if you can, and try and be in a location where you aren't going to be bothered by too many people, because otherwise, it's just kind of bothersome to have all these people wandering around looking at you and checking out what you're trying to do. And especially if you want to run wires out, you want to be away from people, basically. So that's something to look for, is kind of a remote area.
Would being on an island or anything help you out?
The one thing wrong with being on an island is that you don't get the land blockage from one direction. If you're on the shoreline of of the mainland, then you get the land blockage behind you, which can help you out in nulling out the domestic pests, so you can hear the transatlantic signals. But if you get out onto an island, then you no longer have that advantage, because you're surrounded by water. So your domestic stations will be much stronger. In fact, we kind of experienced that on a recent de-expedition to mid-coast Maine. Maine kind of heads more, the coastline is more runs east-west in some sections, and we were in one of those sections, so we didn't have good blockage to the west, and all the Canadian and U.S. High-power or clear-channel domestics were bombing in and actually causing a lot of problems and trying to hear some of the other stuff.
So it really pays to get into an area where you're actually facing directly due east toward area, yeah.
Yeah, and to have the blockage of the land behind you, because that helps a lot.
Do the DXers over in Europe who are on the west coast, say, of England and Spain and stuff, do they hear the United States stuff just as well as you hear the Europeans in Spain?
Oh, yeah. In fact, some of them do better. I recall hearing some reports from DXers in Finland who are picking up Midwestern graveyarders. So that, sure, I guess some of the stations, for instance, in Boston, WRKO, WSSH, WHDH, and so on, they beam their signals at night eastward so they can protect signals to the west. So that enhances the chance of Europeans hearing stations from Boston. Same with New York City and several other coastal cities.
Are some of the European stations directional, or are they mostly non-directional?
Some of them are directional. As I mentioned earlier, that's one of the advantages of listening for dawn enhancement. As the sun is rising in Europe, they're changing their patterns or increasing power, and that improves your chances of hearing them here. So although not as strict as in the United States as far as power reductions go, some of them are still running very high power. 750 kilowatts, 1,000 kilowatts overnight. They aren't quite like the United States, but still, they do change their patterns and power overnight.
We've got a few members who are up in the up in your area there, in the Boston area and such. If you were to give a suggestion on the first couple real gimme stations they should try for, what are the frequencies and stations that would be the top, say, three?
The top three, okay. Let's see. Well, definitely, I think I've already mentioned two of them. 1521 kilohertz, Saudi Arabia, 891 kilohertz, Algeria, and probably for something a little more exotic, 1530 kilohertz, Vatican Radio, which if you null out WSAI from Cincinnati, usually around 0200 to 0300 UTC, they come in pretty good. And they also have a parallel on 5882 kilohertz short wave, so you can identify them that way. But I guess those would be my top three, and then after that you can go for the Spanish stations.
Okay, now what should they listen for if listening for Saudi Arabia? What kind of programming would they have?
For the most part, in Saudi Arabia station, you'll hear Arabic chanting. It's very much, if you watch some of the movies, the stereotypical type of sound you would associate with the Middle East. And you'll pretty much hear the same thing on the station from Algeria.
On 891?
Yes.
Okay. What about Vatican on 1530?
Vatican Radio runs a good variety of music along with religious announcements. In fact, at nightly at 0220 UTC, they'll give an ID in three languages, including Italian and English, and then another language. And as I was saying, you can also pick them up on 5882 shortwave, and that'll help you out in identifying the station. In fact, that's one technique we haven't talked about, and that's using parallels to help you in IDing some of these foreign stations. If you're really having problem with the language or not sure of what you're hearing, then in some cases you can find these stations also broadcasting the same thing on shortwave and use that as a way as identifying the station.
So program them into your 2010 and then just kind of pop back and forth between the two presets.
Yeah, an easy one to try for would be Radio Rebelde from Cuba, which is 710 AM and 5025 shortwave. Or another one perhaps would be Radio Rumbos from Venezuela on 670 AM and 4970 shortwave.
So you can actually just kind of go back and forth. If you hear the same thing, you know you nailed it.
Yep.
Huh. How many stations have you heard so far? I mean, do you keep a log count?
I haven't counted my stations up in a long time. I guess I'm up around 4,000, 5,000 stations that I've heard.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. And I seem to recall in one of the Musings for Members columns in DX News, Ernie Cooper and a few other guys were almost, 4,000, 5,000 plus.
Oh, Ernie Cooper, he's up to well over 4,000 varies. So that's a little different. I don't have that many varies. I've only got maybe a couple of hundred.
Well, it seems like you guys on the East Coast are doing a lot better than us in the Midwest, that's for sure.
Well, I think one advantage you guys in the Midwest have is you've got a lot more open space. Out here in the East Coast, things are pretty well urbanized no matter where you go.
Mm-hmm.
But out in the Midwest, if you can find a friendly farmer or neighbor who's got a lot of land, stretch out a few 1,500 foot or 3,000 foot wires and then see what you'll hear.
Well, this, I was telling Mark earlier, this June I'm going to be going out to North Dakota, and I guess I should probably take along a couple 1,500 foot wires and a tuner and phaser and a few other things, huh?
Yeah, and most definitely. You'll probably be picking up stuff from Central America, Mexico, and you got the guys up north, Manitoba, Sean Axelrod and friends. They're picking up transatlantics and transpacific.
From Winnipeg, you mean?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. I didn't realize you could be able to hear some of the transatlantics from inside continental United States that well.
Well, once again, they're running really long wires. The beverages definitely help because you need that low-angle reception to pull out these stations.
you know, as far as constructing a beverage antenna, is there any particular wire size that you need, or could you use, say, a 22-gauge piece of wire?
That'll work fine. I've read some textbooks that claim that as you get into the medium wave frequencies, there is quite a bit of loss in the smaller gauge wires. So I tend to run more like 18-gauge wire. It's a little more expensive, but although I can't document this as fact, I believe I get better gain out of the heavier gauge wires.
So, like, if someone could find a real flexible multi-core wire that's a 18 gauge and a spool or something to be able to roll it up on, that'd probably be a good good little setup to take with them.
Oh yeah, and in fact, what I do is I go down to the hardware stores such as Home Depot or and HQ, I guess, is another, any of those places, the large warehouse type home centers, and there you can buy wire real cheap, and there's all different styles, and can buy 500-foot rolls, so pretty much that's what I'll do. In fact, I was just down there. I bought some new wire, planning on doing a little antenna work myself later on, and I bought a 500-foot roll of 14-gauge wire for just a little over $7.
Is there a need to have it insulated or not? As I imagine you wouldn't have to have it insulated as long as you suspended it on, like, on wood stakes above the ground.
It's better to have it insulated.
Okay.
Just because even wood is conductive, especially if it decides to rain or something, then that could deteriorate your antenna's performance. Basically, it doesn't, as far as the performance goes, the insulation doesn't affect the performance. The wire picks up the signals just as good. And so I prefer to use insulated wire. That way I can run it over tree limbs, or if there's spots where it's laying on the ground, it's not really going to affect it.
I was, you know, just sitting here thinking while you were describing that, going out to North Dakota, I'll be in a very rural area, and I know in one location where we'll be, there's some old fences and such that, you know, where you have that, lack of a better term, it's like chicken wire fencing that they put along there just to keep the animals from going into the field. Would there be any benefit to stapling a beverage antenna to the top of the post, or should I keep it away from other wires and other objects?
For beverages, it's probably better to keep it away from ground. I guess typically people try and run them a few feet off the ground, although that's not always something you can do. In fact, in Newfie, a lot of the wires were pretty much on the ground, and they still seem to perform fairly well. But it's I think if you had the wire next to or running along a metal fence, that would affect its performance or change its directional characteristics a little. So you might get some interesting results.
And also, I would assume you'd probably not want to try stapling it or attaching it to a phone pole or anything where you have a phone wire or a cable.
Yeah, you don't want to be running parallel to power lines or phone lines or anything like that, because then you'll be picking up the noise off of those guys.
Okay. Any precautions you need to take with beverage antennas when you're using them?
Probably the only precaution is that, number one, when you're not using it, have it disconnected from your radio so you don't get any type of charge buildup or static discharges that could damage your radio. And number two, before you plug in a beverage, just tap it to ground and make sure it's fully discharged, because a really long wire can build up a significant amount of voltage, enough static electricity that you could damage your receiver's input if you aren't careful.
Now, when you're working with a beverage antenna, say, for example, being out in North Dakota or something, if there is a thunderstorm, which is a good distance away, is the beverage antenna going to amplify the static that I'd normally hear?
Sure, it's going to pick up the static from the lightning a lot better than you would normally. A kind of a neat trick you can do is, if you get a neon light bulb during, and you know there are thunderstorms nearby, take a neon light bulb and attach it between the beverage antenna and ground, and you'll actually see the light bulb flash every time there's a lightning strike.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of a neat trick. You could obviously know then whether or not to connect up your antenna to it.
Yeah, I would tend to be careful if you know there's a lightning that's approaching the area, then it's probably best not to use the beverage antenna, because I'd be fearful of damage to your receiver's front end.
As we enter 1995, any good times that people should look for DX? I imagine we've got probably about, we're recording this here in the early part of January. Is there any good DX here still in February and March?
Oh, yeah. In fact, for your transatlantic or transpacific DX, you'll even have better possibilities in April and May. Basically, that's when you kind of get where the sun is more balanced with the Earth, and you're kind of between the summer and the fall seasons. So everyone's on the same par. Whereas, for instance, now in the winter, down to the south, everyone's in summer, so they're getting a lot more sunlight than we are, and therefore their radio signals aren't going to have as much opportunity to make it up this way. But in the spring and in the fall, you'll have a better shot at Africa or Australia, New Zealand, and so on, simply because they're pretty much getting the equal amount of daylight and nighttime as we are up here. So you've got a wider time span in which to listen and hopefully pick up these stations.
What's the worst time of the year to be listening?
Of course, the summertime.
So like around the 20th of June, I think that's the midpoint?
Yeah, or actually into July. I think July is actually worse, just because of the, I suppose June is, it's hard to say. I think probably June and July are the worst months to listen. And then in August, things start to really improve again.
Is there any differences in the seasons between the stations down in South America and the stations out of Europe as far as when they come in and how well they come in?
Well, definitely the fall and spring are your best times for your southern stations, especially south of the equator. As far as hearing Latin Americans, of course, wintertime is the best, because you don't have the problem with atmospheric noise from the lightning storms. And of course, as far as Europe goes, you'll get your cleanest signals during the winter, when both Europe and the United States are dark longer.
Now, Mark and I were talking earlier about the aurora and how it influences some of the propagation of these stations. Is there anything that is kind of a predictor of when you're going to have an auroral condition, which is going to maybe hinder or help you in any way?
The best predictor, of course, is if you can listen to WWV, the Fort Collins, Colorado time station on shortwave. See, 5 megahertz, 10 megahertz are your best signals usually. If you listen 18 past the hour, they'll give a forecast and basically let you know what's going on. And if you've got auroral conditions, or stormy solar conditions, then that's your best time to target stations from the Caribbean and Latin America. And that's probably the worst time to listen for stations from Europe, because the aurora will kill the northern path. Although right now we're at the bottom of the solar cycle, so there really hasn't been much auroral activity, so Europe's coming in just about any night. So as far as over the next season or two, if you get in a rural condition, you'll be pretty lucky, because for the most part, things have been pretty quiet.
And we'll wrap up with Bruce Conti on side number two of this cassette, this large After Dark number 5 edition, and our last 45 minutes of our program. And we surely hope that you've had a chance to listen to everything which is in this series of cassettes, our special anniversary edition from the DX Audio Service, as April will be our 10th anniversary of the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service. So this wraps up side number 1 of cassette number 12. We'll flip it over, and our last 45 minutes is to follow.